I'm just always stuck on always trying this. I try to live on science alone now. Analysis and freaky sensitivity. We gotta live on science alone now. I am a scientist. I am a scientist. I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone now. Religiously, I'm speaking on the science, cause we gotta live on science alone now. Tell you what, mathematically I'm having it. I wanna live on science alone now. I am a scientist. I am a scientist. I am a scientist. We gotta live on science alone.
This is my science project. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. Today's show is a little humorous, a little crass, a little basic, but also a little bit serious. Today we're going to be talking about poo. That's right, the science of poo. And I'll be joined very shortly by my fabulous co-host, Julia, straight out of Calgary, straight to us by the telephone. And Julia conducted a really amazing interview with a UBC Okanagan scientist by the name of Michael Russolo. And he does research with poo, believe it or not. So you're going to hear all about that. We've got all kinds of great stories to support our theme, even a tune or two that I think you'll find amusing. As well as a whole host of upcoming and great science events in the city. So let's just see if Julia's there to join us. Julia, are you there?
I am indeed. Hello, Anne.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well.
Good.
And yourself?
I'm fine. Everything's just running a little bit behind here today. I've even heard that the next show coming up is going to be running a little bit late. And, you know, some days the public transit is with you, and other days it's against you.
Sounds like everyone's in the poo.
And that's the topic of the show today. Hallelujah. Last a show on poo, and as you mentioned in our show last week, we covered what goes in, and today it's just what comes out.
Exactly. And I think we're going to lead with our first story about scientists who are in the poo with their jobs, right?
Yeah, that's right. I'm just shuffling through my stuff, and actually Popular Science magazine came out recently with a list of the top 10 all-time worst jobs in science, and that was released just last month. And as you mentioned, one of those has to do with poo, perhaps not so surprisingly. And it is the whale feces researcher. That came in at number 10 on the top 10 list of all-time worst science jobs. And I don't know about you, Julie, I don't know if you saw the whole list, but for me, I was actually intrigued by a couple of the jobs.
I didn't see the whole list.
One of the jobs was forensic entomologist, and you know, CSI makes that look pretty darn cool. I don't think it could be all that bad.
No, I would think that whale poo would rate higher than number 10 myself.
Well, it came in at number 10, and this is the scoop, basically.
Literally, the scoop.
The scoop, hardy har har. There's going to be all kinds of jokes like that today. So Rosalind Rowland of the New England Aquarium in Boston is a whale feces researcher, and what she does is she heads out to the East Coast, off the coast of Nova Scotia, the Bay of Fundy, looking for whale poo. And it's relevant because she's looking for whale poo from an endangered North Atlantic whale species called the right whales. But why poo, I guess? Why collect poo when you could study the whale itself? But as our listeners will hear later on from our interview with Michael Ruslow, there's a heck of a lot you can tell about an animal from its poo. Everything from pregnancy to hormone levels, genetics, and even you can tell individuals apart by poo studies. And whale feces collection was actually pioneered in 1999, so it's been a bad job since 1999, and already some technological advances have been achieved with the help of dogs. So currently sniffer dogs are used to detect whale droppings, and these dogs can sniff them out from about a mile away, quickly leading researchers on their boat to what happens to be a bright orange and oily mess.
Aww.
That's likely to float around for a little while. So it's collectible and studyable.
Collect and all whale poos.
All this whale poo research has actually led to some individuals catching for the first time on ever on video a whale farting.
I hope they got the sound of that, right?
I think they got it all. Apparently it even smells. Unsurprisingly. So thank goodness for whale research, and thank goodness for those people who do whale feces research. But poo has its uses, and I think you've got a whole list of ways in which poo can be used for fuel.
I do. I'm still reeling a bit from that last... but okay, I've collected myself, and I'll kick off with actually a story that you kind of alluded to earlier when you talked about entomology and forensics. And I'll use that weak seg into the story about a case that was cracked because of dog poo.
Ah.
And this is where from the Australian Broadcasting Corporation reported that in Queensland, there was a sergeant named Alan Piper who, based on work that he'd read about in the FBI, he started to look at really fine details of suspects, like rips in their clothing or tears or stitching. And that actually extended to poo on the shoe. And so his case was called the Poo Shoe Robber, where he managed to convict someone based on the shape of the imprint of the poo that the robber had stepped in. And the imprint left behind matched the shoe of the individual who was the suspect in this case. And just on that evidence alone, the exact match of the shoe print left behind, the actual shoe and the shape of the poo on it, they managed to convict this guy, and now he's in the poo for 10 years.
So I'm just wondering then if CSI has picked up on this story and turned it into one of their own.
Well, I think they should.
As they do.
It sounds fascinating. But, mm-hmm. But poo robbers aside, you mentioned poo power.
Mm-hmm.
So another way that poo can be used for the good of mankind is to actually generate energy. And this is something that's been going on since about 2004 when the first poo fuel cells were being pioneered and reported in the literature. And in fact, in 2004, the London Museum of Science decided that they would use poo fuel cells or microbial fuel cells based on the waste generated by their patrons, by the museum visitors, to power the museum. And how this works is a microbial fuel cell consists of what's really just a tube that contains bacteria. And wastewater from the toilets is then pumped through the tube, and the bacteria feed on the organic matter, or the poo. And then the bacteria release electrons through their membrane into a special carbon paper sheet at the end of the tube, which produces energy kind of like a mini power station. What's also cool about this is that it decreases the amount of oxygen in the water and cleans the water. So it's like a natural poo extraction. Apparently, handmade, low-tech, small biogas plants, which are a similar thing, they've been around for quite a while. They're common in countries like India, China, and Thailand. So this technology isn't new. It's just new to sort of Western countries. And the great thing about it, too, is that the electricity that it produces at least offsets the amount of energy that's required to run the system. And some researchers have calculated that the energy potential in wastewater, like poo water from the toilet, is almost 10 times the cost to treat it. So you're making like 9 times or 10 times back the amount of energy that you're spending just to process the whole thing. And it's so promising that NASA's actually trying to adopt a similar technology to use in manned space missions where they could turn astronauts' waste into extra power.
Yeah, that's incredible. I just came across a little story online today. It may have been covered a little while back about analysis of sewage in European countries and basically correlating time of the week with drug use based on analysis of sewage, which would, of course, include poo. And while you would expect that recreational drug use goes up on Fridays, Saturdays, and Sundays, what has emerged from the analysis of the sewage in places like Italy and Holland, I think, was that people are lying about their drug use too. So in fact, they're actually using drugs a heck of a lot more than they would report in any sort of survey. So let's hear it for what's in our poo. Reveals all and fuels all.
You had an interesting story about panda poo, did you not?
Yeah, I think it's just sort of refining the system that you were talking about in a sense. So it has to do with pandas and panda poo fuel. So it turns out that panda poo may be both a fuel and a waste disposal solution, much like the way you described it. And the way this was developed came from the knowledge that, you know, pandas eat a heck of a lot of bamboo, which is a really tough dinner to digest and to swallow. And a researcher from Kitasato University in Japan, by the name of Fumiaki Taguchi, reasoned that the digestive abilities of the bacteria in the gut of the panda could be harnessed and put to even better use, because they just must have extraordinary powers in digesting protein and fat and sugar and so on. So in analysis of panda poo, they identified 5 such bacteria that were essential for digestion of bamboo, and observe their ability to consume and convert vegetable waste. So within 17 weeks, 100 kilograms of vegetable waste was reduced to just 3 kilograms of residue, and 100 liters of hydrogen was produced per kilogram of this waste. So that's where the hydrogen can be harnessed and used to power a hydrogen fuel cell, which is where this research is being directed. So, you know, let's hear it for panda poo.
That's truly ingenious.
Yeah. Was there another poo fuel story?
Well, there was, picking up on the poo fuel story, turkey litter is another power source. This is from an article in 2007, just earlier this spring, reported from Minnesota, that apparently in the state, there's about, let me see, where's my fact? Anyway, there's like tons of poo from turkeys produced in the U.S. every year. And it's just been laid down, and of course the waste has been left to waste. But there's been a new used for turkey poo, which is to fuel a $200 million power plant that's due to begin full-scale production. Actually, it's probably already started. It was meant to start in June, so last month. And it's the first poultry litter-fired power plant in the United States, and it should be able to provide renewable energy that will yield enough power for 50,000 homes. And that's going to be a template for other power plants that they're going to try and introduce in major poultry states in the U.S., like Arkansas.
You know, it's amazing. We just kind of delivered a bit of a rapid-fire collection of neat little poo stories. But in truth, it's been extraordinarily difficult to turn up such stories on this theme. And I don't know about you, but in terms of researching themes, this has been among one of the most difficult ones that we've done since My Science Project hit the airwaves. And it's clear that there's a lot to be discovered and gained if people are just willing to dig in and deal with the poo.
And muck about.
And we also had a bit of a tough time finding poo songs, but you turned up one from Scrubs. Do you want to introduce that tune?
I did. Thank God for YouTube. This is something that was taken from a Scrubs episode. I don't know what inspired them to do this musical number, but you can tell they truly were inspired. I think this is, what is this called, the poo song, something like that, from Scrubs.
Here it is.
Hey, Miss Miller, we just need a stool sample.
Why do you need a stool sample if you think I'm just a nut?
'Cause the answer's not in your head, my dear, it's in your butt. You see, everything comes down to poo. From the top of your head to the sole of your shoe, we can figure out what's wrong with you by looking at your poo.
Turk, do you have a hemorrhoid or is it rectal cancer? When you flush your dookie down, you flush away the answer.
It doesn't really matter if it's hard or if it's loose. We'll figure out what's ailing you as long as it's a deuce.
Yes!
Everything comes down to poo.
Everything comes down to
cardiovascular and lymphatic, yes, the nervous system too. All across the nation, we trust in defecation. Everything comes down to poo.
If you want to know what's wrong, don't sit and act so cool. Just be a man and eat some bread and drop the kids off at the pool.
My stomach hurts.
Check the poo.
Sprained my ankle.
Check the poo.
I was shot.
Check the poo.
A homeless guy threw poo in my eye.
Check the poo.
Mine are his.
First him, then you. It may sound gross. You may say shush. But we need to see what comes out of your tush. Because everything comes down to poo. Pinch us off a big fat clue.
Our number one test is your number two.
If there's no precise unmatched please, everything comes down to
doo-doo, 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 doo-doo.
Everything comes down to poo.
On Saturday, July 21st, Out on Screen presents Queerwood, Lights, Camera, Auction. Take a walk down the pink carpet and come celebrate the launch of the 19th Annual Vancouver Queer Film Festival, an evening of quickie flicks, queer burlesque, and a silent auction with over $35,000 worth of fabulous items. Proceeds go to support the annual Vancouver Queer Film Festival, Out in School's anti-homophobia program, and the newly created Queer History Project. Tickets available at ticketstonight.ca, Little Sisters Book and Art Emporium, and Black Dog Video. Queerwood, Lights, Camera, Auction, Saturday, July 21st at the Van City Theatre, 1181 Seymour Street.
Hi, you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and this is My Science Project, a science and technology show that today is talking about poo, believe it or not. And next up is an interview that was conducted by Julia, my co-host, who is joining me here from Calgary. Hey, Julia.
Hello, Anne.
Hey, tell me more about this interview.
Well, this is with Michael Rostello, who is an assistant professor in biology at the University of British Columbia in Okanagan. And Michael does all kinds of cool research. He does some stuff on Galapagos turtles, ecology, and stuff like that. And among his many projects is one that is looking at tigers and their poo. And I won't say much more because we talk about it in the interview. So if you would like to do the honors, Anne.
Yeah, here we go.
Can you tell me what it is that you're doing in particular with the tigers to try and preserve them, essentially?
I mean, as you probably know, tigers are, you know, threatened and endangered really across their entire distribution. And the Amur tiger is the northernmost population subspecies of tigers. And it used to have a very broad distribution throughout northeastern China, Korean Peninsula, and also in the southernmost regions of the Russian Far East. Well, the Amur tiger has undergone severe population bottleneck in recent times, primarily due to human population growth and habitat loss, so that this subspecies that, you know, used to number potentially thousands was reduced to about 20 to 30 individuals back in the mid-1900s. So quite a severe decline in population size. And so based upon those estimates, a number of protective legislations were enacted that, you know, protected the habitat and from actually harvesting the tigers, so that they've been able to do have a population rebound.
And when you say harvesting, you mean like putting some groups in captivity, or what does that mean?
So the harvesting for, you know, the East Asian markets, tiger parts, in particular the penis, has been seen as an aphrodisiac. And so that was actually a significant amount of take on tigers and put some, you know, continue to put pressure on them. But actually, there's legislation now that bans all trade in tigers and tiger parts. And so because of this protection, they've been able to rebound. Estimates are around 400, 450 individuals remaining. So that was a long way of getting to your question, is that we were interested to see what the genetic consequences were of this extreme reduction in population size and then subsequent expansion.
So that's about 20 to 30 individuals, you were saying 300, 400 that are now in the wild?
Yes.
Right. And so what are you finding? What are the differences, if any, in genotype, I suppose, in genetic variation between the wild population and you also in your work, you compare that to tigers in captivity, too, I believe.
Yes. So initial study looked at mitochondrial DNA variation in the wild population of the Amur tigers, and that relied on scat or feces that were collected from throughout their range in the Russian Far East. And so from that, we were able to extract DNA and sequence a fragment of the mitochondrial DNA genome. And in comparing that across the entire sampling throughout the distribution, we found a very low level of variation. And actually, we only found three different haplotypes, three different forms of Amur tigers the sampling, actually, of almost 100 individuals. Within that sampling, 95% of the individuals were identical, and then there were a couple rare substitutions, rare variants out there. So it's an extremely low level of variation that was detected.
And this has implications because variation can be a pretty good thing in terms of keeping up the health of the population?
Yeah, genetic variation is the, you know, the pool on which, you know, evolution acts. And it, you know, it's seen as procuring or allowing a species to have evolutionary potential, a potential to change with a changing environment into the future. And so, one commonly pointed to detriment of having low variation is, you know, a loss of this resilience to change in the environment in the future. And so when you see a situation like the Amur tiger with, you know, very low levels of variation, at least in the regions that we studied, that's always a fear.
Let's get back to the methods that you used to determine this. So I'm curious if you could tell me a bit more about how you extract DNA from scat.
scat on the scat or on the surface are sloughed off cells from the intestine, from the rectal lining. So it's on the very surface of the feces that we want to target. And so it's just a matter of acquiring that surface level DNA. And so it requires some scrapings from the surface, a number of washes and specific laboratory techniques. I don't know how much specifics you want me to get into, but it's not as conventional as, say, extracting DNA from blood or from a fresh tissue sample. But there are a lot of benefits to using feces as a source of DNA.
Do tell.
Well, for one, tigers aren't easy to find in the wild, and they're even more difficult to capture. And not to say that we even should. I mean, a highly threatened, highly endangered species, the least invasive that we can be in studying them, the better. And so scat is ideal in this regard because it can be found, associated with their footprints, their paw prints in the snow. It can be collected from a wide range of individuals without ever actually having to see one, or in the case of the tigers, having to handle them. So in that regard, it's really the ideal way of doing a comprehensive population genetic survey.
And I gather you know that each sample is coming from a different individual because of the readout that you're getting from the DNA, because clearly looking at a piece of scat is probably not going to be too informative.
Yeah, absolutely. And there's a number of ways we can do that. One of our initial studies focused on mitochondrial DNA, which does not allow for that individual identification. And so we had to use some surrogate measures to bin samples and assume that samples collected within a given area were deposited by a single individual. Okay, so not a very accurate way of doing it, but one that's conventionally used in field biology and field surveys. But now we can use different markers, nuclear markers, known as microsatellites, and these can provide a genetic fingerprint, and so we can actually very accurately identify the number of individuals that we sampled. Just as an example, we sampled 95 scat samples in the initial survey, and based upon that field-based grouping technique, we came up with a conservative estimate that those 95 scat samples were deposited by only 27 individuals. So we wanted to be very conservative in that. In actuality, when we went back to look at some microsatellite genotypes to fingerprint them, we found that number was closer to 60 individuals that we had sampled in the 95 scat specimens collected. So it allowed us for a much greater level of accuracy in our sample size.
Yeah, that's pretty impressive, actually, that you get that much information from scat. So the DNA, I gather the integrity of the molecules is pretty stable.
It's not excellent. You typically get DNA of lower quality and lower quantity when you're working with scat, and this is relative to other tissue types that we can get DNA from. And so there are limitations in the sense that to recover, for example, mitochondrial DNA is very routine, but to begin to look at some of these nuclear regions, like nuclear microsatellites, it requires many repeated sampling and surveys for every single specimen collected to be sure that we're getting the most accurate information.
Is this technique fairly standard, or is it something that is new to the field that you guys are pioneering?
I would say it's been around for about 10 years, and so it's fairly new in that regard, but a lot of people jumped at the opportunity to begin working with this material because, working with species that might be difficult to handle, to find, to sample in the wild. Some of the first work in this regard was done with seals in the British Isles, and one of the ideas was to be able to identify exactly what species were residing in certain areas and to get an initial estimate of how many of each species that there were from collecting from a common pool of scat in these areas. And a lot of other work involving large carnivores, bears, gray wolves, red wolves, that was some of the early work using scat.
And I gather it's pretty easy to recognize tiger scat from any other that's sitting around in the forest.
It definitely has a unique morphology to those who are skilled in identifying scat. But you know, another way of ensuring that, you know, without having to go necessarily to the DNA level, is looking for scat that's deposited near prints, paw prints. Mm. So all the scat was actually collected in the wintertime, and this is in the Russian Far East, so it's snow covered, so it's easily be able to identify tiger tracks, one. And two, the cold and dry climate allowed for better preservation of the DNA as well.
Right. So to round out our interview, what is going to happen with all this information that's come from tiger scat?
Well, we hope to continue to monitor the wild population. So by collecting specimens in multiple sampling years, we can begin to get some estimates of population size, changes in population sizes over time. We can look at looking at the genetic structure of the population over the wide geographic area to see if there's any subdivision and whether or not there might be some distinct barriers for dispersal and gene flow. So that's regards to monitoring the wild population. But another component of the study that you alluded to was comparing what we find in the wild to the large captive populations that are maintained worldwide. It's estimated that there are more Amur tigers in captivity than there are in the wild. And so the degree to which the genetic variation in captivity reflects that found in the wild is an interesting question, whether or not there may be more variation, for example, found in captivity. Is one of the lines of inquiry that we're pursuing.
And if there was more variation in captivity, would you consider breeding schemes to introduce that to the wild?
Absolutely. And there's some creative ways of doing that. One of which is reintroducing individuals that might possess novel genotypes or genetic forms that we could detect. But other ways are actually being experimented with is in artificial insemination. So if you have a male that has novel alleles, novel genetic forms in captivity, one idea is to use his sperm as a source for artificial insemination of a wild female.
That's just really cool and kind of yucky stuff. But
they are tigers and they are a flagship species for conservation, and unfortunately there are funds for helping to maintain their protection.
And I imagine that within their own ecosystems there are fairly key species as well that if they were removed the network, the web would not fare well.
Absolutely. I mean, and you see that over and over again when looking at top predators and when they are removed from a given system, the implications that can cascade down the different trophic levels. So yes, they are quite important in an ecological sense as well.
Well, best of luck in your research, Mike.
Well, thank you.
And thank you for talking with me.
No problem, Julia.
Okay, bye.
Bye now.
May I beg you?
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, and you first heard an interview conducted with Julia and Michael Russolo about the way he uses poo in his research, and that was followed by We Tigers by Animal Collective from Sung Tong. So, yeah, this is the poo show. This is my science project. You know, sometimes we go there. And I've got a pretty hilarious story about caterpillars and what they do with their poo. And one of the reasons I like this story is that it introduced me to a new and delicate term for poo, and that term is frass, apparently highly used in the academic poo community. And I got a real kick out of that. So this, indeed, was an academic publication in an academic journal. It had an abstract, it had an introduction, it had testable hypotheses, it had methods, it had results, it had discussion. It was a genuine, respectable paper. It just happened to be about poo. And if you took a quick look at the key words listed in this paper, you would see such things as defecation and fecal pellet and frass. And so I knew I was on to something good for this show. It was published in Ecology Letters by Martha Weiss from the Biology Department of Georgetown University. And the topic, the title of this paper was Good Housekeeping, Why Do Shelter-Dwelling Caterpillars Fling Their Frass? So this is a story about caterpillars and the largely ignored but essential behavior of defecation. Now, caterpillars, as you probably know, have pretty high site fidelity. So in other words, they pick a leaf, they build a shelter, and they live there for a long time. And this raises a few issues, particularly in the absence of flush toilets. So living in proximity to accumulated waste, as you can imagine, could cause a lot of problems. It could, first of all, increase exposure to toxins or pathogens. It might simply physically crowd the animals, and it might also provide signals to other enemies. And so these sort of possible reasons to get rid of one's frass sort of form the basis of this study. And to escape one or all of these issues, what caterpillars have developed the ability to do is to fling their poo. And believe it or not, these little critters, about 4 centimeters long, can fling their poo 153 centimeters. That would be 38 times their body length. That would be like me flinging my poo 7 meters. So extraordinary indeed. But it's not just a descriptive study. It's not just looking at distances of poo flinging. It also asks why. Why would the caterpillars fling their poo? And do any of those three hypotheses, exposure to pathogens, crowding the animals, or signals to enemy, do any of those offer an explanation for why a caterpillar would fling their frass? So first, the descriptive part. Like I said, they can fling their frass up to 38 times their body length. Normally, on average, it's about 20 times their body length. And the average rate is 1 to 2 times per hour. So they're busy playing football with their frass. But like I said, the most important part here is why. Why fling one's frass? And to test the pathogen avoidance hypothesis, the caterpillars were reared in boxes that were either cleaned regularly or not cleaned at all. And not cleaning them all was referred to as the frassy treatment, which I thought was cute. And although fungus did grow in the dirtier boxes, both of the larvae performed similarly in measures of their health and well-being and longevity and that sort of thing. So it didn't appear to be avoidance of infection that motivated the frass flinging. So the next hypothesis was crowding. You know, if poo gets in the way, that's going to drive the caterpillars out of their shelter, and building a new shelter is energetically expensive in terms of energy costs. So that might be a good reason to fling their frass. So what Dr. Weiss did was to test the energy cost of building a new shelter, because she'd already demonstrated that, you know, increased flat frass buildup leads to caterpillars moving on. But does that really cost them any energy? And the way she tested this was to force a set of the caterpillars to build a new home every couple of days, and then to assess the weight gain and mass of the animals who had to build regularly a new home versus those who didn't. And she found that there was very little change. So that eliminates the crowding hypothesis, which leads the hypothesis that flinging your frass will help avoid natural enemies. So by getting rid of perhaps a scent cue to enemies such as wasps. So to test whether frass ejection helps avoid detection by wasps, fresh frass, or as a control, they just use black glass beads, which I guess look a bit like caterpillar poo. And those were placed into caterpillar shelters. And the larvae was removed, leaving behind the frass or the frass substitutes. And so this sort of setup acted as a bait for foraging wasps. And wasps were introduced into this poo or fake poo situation, and the number of visits to the various conditions was recorded. In another experiment, wasps were offered the choice of two similar leaves, each bearing a caterpillar, one with poo and one with the poo decoy. And wasps were introduced, and the caterpillar first discovered was noted, as well as the caterpillar killed first. So what they learned was that the presence of frass leads to longer and more frequent visits by wasps and the enemy, and also it significantly increases the likelihood of death. So wasps were likely to choose the caterpillar that were sitting next to their own poo. So all in all, this data comes in supporting the hypothesis that caterpillars fling their frass in order to avoid detection by predators. And another one, not only did I learn the word frass, but another one of my favorite things about this paper, albeit a bit trivial, was that they collected both the caterpillars and the leaves used in this experiment right from their very own campus. So I got a real kick out of that one. Julia is joining me here from Calgary, and before we sign off and leave you to stereoscopic readout, we wanted to update you on what's going on in town, in our towns, in Vancouver and Calgary. So first and foremost, Café Scientifique is coming up here in Vancouver on July 24th. That's a Tuesday. As always, it's at the Railway Club. As always, it's free. And this particular event will feature Murray B. Eisman, who is Dean and Professor in the Faculty of Land and Food here at UBC. And he will be speaking under the title Plant Essential Oils, Aromatherapy for the Pesticide Industry. So he is looking at the role of natural oils to act as pesticides, which should be a pretty cool talk. Julia, did you have something going on there in Calgary?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I thought this was really interesting. There's not too much for people to do now about it, except maybe, I guess, see what happens. But it's certainly, if people want to get involved later on, this is maybe some interesting information. And enough with the cryptic. This is a story about Canada's Olympic mathletes coming to the University of Calgary and to Banff to practice and train in time for the 48th International Mathematical Olympiad, or the IMO, which is going to be held in Hanoi, Vietnam, from July 19th to 31st. So just this past week, from July 6th to the 10th, they had a suite of students. They are usually high school student level, grades 7 to 12, who came to work. They're the Canadian IMO team members. These were selected from among more than 200,000 students who participated in local, provincial, and national mathematics contests. And when these young brainiac mathematicians go to Hanoi, they'll be pitting their skills against more than 500 of the world's best math students from 98 countries, which is really darn impressive. And if you want to know more, you can visit the website for the International Math Olympiad, which is www.imo2007.edu.vn/. And if you want to get involved here in Canada, the Canadian Mathematical Society has a website. That's www.cms.math.ca/competition. And I think, Anne, you had some experience as a youngin' with math stuff.
I did, and I dare not go there just now. What I do want to mention before we say good evening and good night is that MOST, which is Microvariability and Oscillations of Stars satellite, one of Canada's most amazing satellites that's led by UBC's Jamie Matthews, is celebrating its fourth birthday. And rather than accepting gifts, they're kind of giving a gift. They're inviting Canadians to submit proposals for their own observation projects. So this is your opportunity to design design an experiment that might be conducted on the MOST satellite. So the science team from MOST will select the best and most feasible proposal and work with the winner to collect and analyze the data and possibly publish the results. So that's a really fabulous opportunity for any budding astronomers out there. Check out astro.ubc.ca/MOST and bring on your ideas. So I think it's time for us to say goodbye. Thanks for joining me from Calgary, Julia.
Hello, everyone, and thanks for joining me from Calgary via Vancouver.
It's all very complex, isn't it?
It's been really cool doing these joint shows.
Yeah, and we'll say goodnight. And yeah. I'll leave you with another science tune that we've unearthed by Tom Green called Science is Everywhere. Thanks for listening.
This may date me a little bit, but I speak the truth. I'm not going to lie to you people. I'm amazed by the things that I see around me every day in this world. I'm amazed.
Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere. Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere.
When I was a kid, we didn't have microwave ovens. We heated up shit in the stove like if we wanted Chef Boyardee. We get a pot, boil that shit till it's nice and hot. We did dandy without CDs, video games and MP3s and FTPs. Toss snowballs at police and get chased. As much fun as anybody could take, we would walk down the street with a ghetto blaster. Playing cassettes by Flash the Grandmaster. Guy around the corner had an 8-track. We all used to laugh, but behind his back. Then one day, I got a calculator watch. Cheated on my grade 5 math class and got caught. One kid had a Walkman, he was rich. I used to watch him walking to the beat and shit. See, back in the day, it was fun but simple. I'd never seen a VCR when I popped my first pimple. My TV was black and white. You ever watch The Love Boat in black and white? That shit's aight. Ah, shit. I sound like Randy Jackson, but back in the day, I had a jacket like Michael Jackson. Red leather walking backwards, no traction. Moonwalking was a national passion. Science
is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere. Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere.
When I was a kid, we just got indoor plumbing. We used to shit out beside the house. I'd walk 4 miles to school and wig out. No, that's what my dad was all about. I remember the day I saw my first ATM machine. Brand new, all shiny and clean. I thought it was a video game and put a quarter in it. I thought it was a Coke machine, put my order in it. See, I was born in 1971. We would play Evel Knievel, slingshots, BB guns, and go to the river and make booby traps for fun. Pretending to be Rambo, run Rambo, run. I had one of those knives that you could unscrew the bottom and stretch Armstrong. That thing was friggin' awesome. Hide under the couch, pretend to be Steve Austin. Watch Punky Brewster or
Blossom.
Then Pong came along and it was holy fuck. My parents didn't get it, there was no such luck. I made best friends with the kid down the block. I didn't really like him, but his Pong really rocked.
Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere. Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Spacecraft are everywhere. Science is everywhere. Computers are everywhere. Robots are everywhere. Color TVs are everywhere. Color TVs are everywhere.